Welcome. I'm Warren Odess Gillette, and this is A Baha'i Perspective. Welcome to A Baha'i Perspective. I recorded an interview with Mary Darling on June 24th, 2024. She's the co-founder of the production company West Wind Pictures, a leading independent media production company dedicated to creating thought-provoking content for a global audience. From award-winning scripted series to lifestyle shows, documentaries, and children's media, their diverse productions have earned international acclaim. We talk about the films they've produced in the interview. I started the interview by asking Mary where she grew up and what was religious life like growing up.
So I actually grew up in Minnesota, just outside of Minneapolis, in a place called Excelsior. People will know kind of the area I'm from if they know where Prince is from. Chanhassen was the other place that I straddled. Lotus Lake was right between Excelsior and Chanhassen. I grew up in a family raised up as a Catholic, went to a really little tiny church in Chanhassen, which was actually called St. Hubert's. It's still there, sort of moved over from Germany brick by brick. And I think I had a very happy early religious life because our priest really didn't take at first to Vatican II. So when I was a child, he didn't bother to turn around and address us in English. He was still doing the Mass in Latin. And I would say it probably influenced my early life because I found it to be very mystical and warm and wonderful at the church. And I also had a grandmother, I think, who was very foundational in my early upbringing from a faith standpoint. My grandmother was incredibly faithful. And at my house growing up, you know, we prayed in church. We didn't pray very much at home. I was one of nine kids. But I remember my grandmother and grandfather visiting, and when I was about 5 or 6 years old, I walked into their room while they were praying, and I felt kind of embarrassed, like I was interrupting them doing something that I shouldn't be seeing. And rather than making me feel that way, they called me in, sat me down on the bed between them, and then continued to say prayers. And it was really a beautiful and very formative experience for me. I think I was always spiritually curious. I remember when I was a teenager, I bought the Bhagavad Gita at a garage sale. I loved to go garage selling with my grandmother and my mom. And my mom thought it was pretty curious that I bought that. I don't think she had ever heard of the Bhagavad Gita before. And when I was in high school, because we learned later that my dad's mom was Jewish, she had been disowned from her family because she married somebody who wasn't Jewish. I had big questions in high school about religion in general, like, what is it that makes it all work? Or why do people believe the things that they believe? Or do we just believe things the way that they are because we were raised that way, or because we were told we had to, or because maybe we investigated a little bit and kind of figured out there was a direction in our life? But for me, I was in high school. I had just gotten my driver's license, and I started going really to churches and synagogues and temples and interviewing the cleric from all of these different places, and also interviewing congregants. And I would say at the end of that kind of spiritual investigation, what I learned, first of all, is that a lot of people don't really know very much about their own religion. So they haven't really investigated religion for themselves. And so even sort of as a high schooler, getting people to articulate why they believe what they believe and things like that, so often people simply fell back on the idea that that's how they were raised. So this whole investigation that I was on was highly unusual, I guess, although I think a lot of people really do have questions around religion and why they believe what they believe, or are there other people who believe things like they do? And finally, after I graduated from high school, I met a man who had asked me out, and he said to me, "I'm a Baha'i, that means I believe in Baha'u'llah." For me, I'd never heard of the Baha'i faith. I had never heard the word Baha'u'llah. And of course, it was a little bit before iPhones or Google. And so I found myself at the library the next day sort of phonetically working out with the librarian what I thought I heard. And using the old card catalog system, we finally came upon the word Baha'i and the word Baha'u'llah, and I checked out a couple of books. And it was interesting because I would say in that earlier part of my investigation, where I was interviewing clerics and interviewing congregants, I came away with an idea that it seems like there's one God who I would say sends messengers for us to understand him more, and that there were both spiritual teachings and social teachings. I would say that I came out, even if I wouldn't have articulated it in that way, at the time, I think that's what I came away with. And so when I read the writings from the Baha'i faith, particularly the writings of Baha'u'llah, I found a great resonance. And the funny thing is that I realized about 2 years later when I went to a Baha'i holy day that the kid who sat behind me in my creative writing class was a Baha'i. And he never told me. While I was going through all of that investigation, he never told me he was a Baha'i. And I think it's probably because he and his brother and his parents had just moved from Iran. It was during the revolution in Iran. So this would have been in 1980, 81. And I think he was kind of laying low. But I ran into him a couple of years after I became a Baha'i at a Baha'i holy day in Minneapolis. And that was a very funny moment.
What was it that convinced you or caused you to take on the Baha'i faith as your spiritual path?
What a beautiful question, Warren. For me, I think it was probably laid down first in that independent investigation that I went on in high school, really seeing and understanding the various religions and why people were engaged with them, and feeling like it was really one big story. That meaning in a good way, one narrative that God sends these messengers through time to help us advance in our understanding and train and raise up our capacities in the world in order to advance civilization. For me, the idea of a religion that was focused very much on the oneness of the world of humanity, the idea that there's one God and that really there's ultimately one common faith, that it advances through time and advances through, you know, God sending us messengers. The other thing that really resonated with me was this idea of God being unknowable, an unknowable essence that we could know through his messengers or through the manifestations of God like Jesus and Muhammad and Krishna and Zoroaster and Buddha. And that to me really resonated, I think, because when you allow yourself to understand that, you realize that God never leaves us alone, that he cares for all of us. And the idea that God doesn't come to kind of create a certain group, which somehow is more informed or more spiritual or more advanced than any others, that it's much more basic than that, in fact, that God sends messengers because he loves us and he cares for our well-being. And so he brings us spiritual teachings and material guidance. That just made a lot of sense to me logically. Like it wasn't something that was woo-woo or super mystical, mm-hmm. but that it was quite practical. And because I loved Jesus so much, the idea that there's continuity, that I don't somehow give away or reject belief that I have in Jesus when I become a Baha'i, that came very much with me.
What was your family's reaction to you becoming a Baha'i?
My family's reaction, it was interesting because at the time that I was really investigating the faith, there were books out at the time that sort of listed the Baha'i faith as a cult or as a sect of Islam. There was a lot of misinformation in the published world at that time. And so there was a lot of conversation in my family and a lot of concern, especially from my father, who was very worried about me. I mean, I was 18 years old. I had always been very involved with my church. I was the chairman of the youth committee. And I think that he thought I was getting mixed up in something that was maybe going to be harmful to me. And in the end, when I had the conversation with my dad where I said, I've decided that I need to pursue this for myself, he said then basically we shouldn't be in touch anymore.
Oh, bye.
Yeah, it was very difficult. And for about a year, we weren't. And it was very hard for me because my dad was very much the doorway into my family. Like I really, really was so connected with him. And then it was like he just saw that I was advancing okay, and it wasn't bad. Sort of got that news through my sister, who was sort of an intermediary at some level, I guess. And then he called me out of the blue one day and said, "I just don't understand why you don't come out for dinner anymore." And I said, "Yeah, I think that would be good. I think I should do that more." And then for a number of years, we didn't talk about it at all. And then the funny thing is, when I was living later, about 4 years later, I was living in Philadelphia, and the Philadelphia Inquirer had done this nice story on our family because we were living at that time, just my husband and I and our firstborn child. We were living in this black community just outside of Philadelphia. It's what we could afford. He was going to Temple University, and it was really the sweetest experience of my life. I still have very strong, lasting friendships from that place. But the Philadelphia Inquirer wrote an article about us being a minority in a minority population or something like that. And it was about not just being white, but also being Baha'is. And it was actually pretty accurate. Like, it talked about the principles of the Baha'i faith, the teachings of the Baha'i faith. And it was a really nice article with the story of our daughter, you know. And I thought, I really would like my dad to see this. The article talked about the need to overcome prejudices of every kind, a need for a universal auxiliary language, the recognition of one God, one humanity, and sort of one overall common faith, these kinds of things. Anyway, so my dad was coming for Christmas, my mom and dad, to visit my sister in Washington, D.C. And of course, we decided that we would all gather there because it was nearby. And I remember taking this newspaper article and like printing it and reducing it down to its smallest possible size, which I think is like an exercise in psychology because I was afraid to show it to him, but I also wanted to be able to share this thing that was so important to me. So I remember being at my sister's house. Everybody went into the kitchen except for my dad and I, and I courageously took this thing out of my purse, this, you know, like full-size article reduced down to like a legal size. You could hardly read it when I think back now. And I handed it to him, and I sat down on the floor next to him, which really is a study in psychology. In every way, I was trying to make this as small a deal as it could be and yet still share it. And he sat patiently. He read the whole article. And then he looked at me and he said, "Doesn't a father get an original of something like this?" And that was the beginning of like a very open discourse that we had until his passing. It wasn't constant, it wasn't every conversation, but he had a lot of questions, you know, a lot of reflection just based on the life that he led, you know, serving in the Korean conflict and wondering why these things happen in the world and how things will ever resolve. And he really came to terms at the end of his days, I think, feeling like the Baha'i faith or the Baha'i teachings offer guidance to humanity to try to move us into a lasting peace. And even I'm thankful for the conflict at the beginning because I think it drew his attention to it. First of all, it demonstrated that he cared about me, very much so, that he was so worried that he was willing to sacrifice our relationship even if that meant it was going to wake me up. And that then we maintained that relationship through to the end so that through mutual and gradual and long-lasting contact, you know, a greater understanding emerged for both of us.
Was your grandmother alive when you became a Baha'i?
She was. My grandmother was fantastic. I gave her this prayer once. This prayer, it goes, and it became her favorite prayer and my mother's favorite prayer. It's a prayer that says, "Oh God, refresh and gladden my spirit, purify my heart, illumine my powers." And it goes on. It's absolutely a beautiful prayer. And I remember giving that to my grandmother after I became a Baha'i. I made a little calligraphy, like 5x7 postcard, and framed it for her. And I gave it to her. She was a farmer in southwestern Minnesota, she and my grandfather. And I gave her this little quote, and she said, "Oh, Mary," she said, "I'm going to put this right by the coffee pot so that everybody who comes to the house can read it." And so we went together and we put a little nail on the wall next to her coffee pot, and she hung that prayer there, which hung there until the house was sold after her death. And I remember at the dining room table, she used to say, you know, we always said a prayer before meals. And she'd always say, oh, Mary's here. Let's have her say one of her Baha'i prayers. She just really, really was so supportive, which I also think because my parents are obviously, we're very close with, you know, my mom. That was my mom's mom. There was such a tender love there that I think her acceptance also helped my dad accept.
Now, you are co-founder of West Wind Pictures. And the first thing I want to ask is, what was your journey that led you to being in film?
You know, my journey was a long one. It's funny, my husband had gone to Temple University in Philadelphia for his Master of Fine Arts in Radio TV Film. And at that time, I was working in advertising. I'd worked in theater, and then I worked in some live meeting planning, like big things, like topping off of buildings in Philadelphia, or helped with the coordination of the We the People 200 celebration, the 200th anniversary of the Constitution, these kinds of things back in the day. And so I was always involved in kind of theater or storytelling or producing live events. He was doing his MFA in radio, TV, film, and I was helping him, you know, produce little short films and stuff like that for his studies. And they give you all kinds of fun assignments that we would do together. And I had already really fallen in love and enjoyed kind of telling the, you know, the 30-second story, the 30-second commercial, you know, and had done some account management for like McDonald's on the East Coast, the Ronald McDonald coordinator for the East Coast for a little bit, and the account manager for Oscar Mayer, got to do a very short drive in the Oscar Mayer Wienermobile. And so that was a very interesting and very organic way of sort of realizing in everything that I had ever done, I was always engaging with story and always trying to figure out how to share that story. So it felt a very natural step to sort of begin to leap into that in a more profound way, sometimes with live events and sometimes with, you know, smaller either commercials or smaller films. But I wasn't trained in film myself. I would say I was trained sort of in the shadow of my husband as he got his MFA, and then through experience and just making things and learning from others. And even with this film that I'm working on right now, I pulled in a director friend of mine, Michael Kennedy, who's just like a master of directing and breaking down scripts and working through shots and all of that. And we got together the other night and spent time, you know, trying to figure out the best way to approach the film I'm doing right now. So I would say you're never fully in it. You're always kind of learning how to be in it. And every project that you engage in teaches you something new about what you're doing wrong or what you could do better. It's kind of like that. But I would say from my very earliest kind of middle school and high school years, I was in a lot of theater productions and things like that, and knew that I loved that expression of sharing stories with others.
What inspired you to actually found West Wind Pictures with others?
West Wind, it's interesting because my husband, Clark, actually founded West Wind in 1989 out in Saskatchewan. And they were doing, at that time, a lot of commercial work as well. They had done a talk show for the national broadcaster here in Canada called What on Earth for CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. And so he had already founded that out in Saskatchewan, and I joined the company in 97, I think. And, you know, we moved to Toronto area and really started to try to work in series, to move away from commercial, which he also comes from, and move it into more of a scripted series. And so founding the company, I would say, in Canada, in a way, it's a means to be able to attract funding, to be a bona fide company, because otherwise you could do a lot of what we do as freelancers as well. But in terms of applying, it's kind of a means to an end, applying for funding and being a bona fide company that can attract tax credits or do its own distribution and things like that, that formal structure sort of gives you that to play inside of. And then it also allows you to build that brand so people know that if they're working with West Wind Pictures, I hope that they would know that they're trying to work with people who, or that they're working with people who try to be trustworthy, treat people well, that kind of thing. So, yeah, trying to live our faith also inside of that company.
I went to your website and I see that you have four categories of films. I wonder if you could just briefly describe those before we get into your latest project.
When you live in and work in Canada, it's a little bit different than the U.S., of course, where I'm from originally. People in the U.S., once you do something, you sort of start to get pigeonholed, or you can get pigeonholed. I'm not saying everybody is, but you can be. So if you're a production company that does comedy, then that's who you are. If you're a production company that does lifestyle, then that's who you are, or children's or anything like that. In Canada, it's a little bit different in that, well, you just have to be good at many different things in order to basically stay in business. You know, it's a much smaller population. The license fees and things and making things is perhaps smaller. And so when we're thinking about what we want to do, we're not necessarily starting by thinking about a genre. We're actually starting by thinking about if we identify kind of a need in the community. And so, for example, we've worked in children's a couple of times, and my favorite thing that we've done in the children's category is a show called The Art Show. And The Art Show came out of a place in me where, after parenting a number of kids and having grandkids now, I didn't see a lot of interesting shows on TV that really brought forward a kid's voice, B, something that wasn't a cartoon, and C, something that really celebrates beauty. And so we did a show called The Art Show, which is 51 5-minute episodes for the national broadcaster here in Canada. And that show really follows a kid through inspiration and then creating art. And all of it is through their own choice and lens, and also their own voice narrating it. And it's just one of the sweetest things I think we've done. I think it really touches a place for kids where we acknowledge that they are thinking, curious, creative people. So that's children's. And then we've also worked a lot in lifestyle, which we haven't done for some time. We sort of started to get known as the lifestyle producers here in Canada. We did a lot of interior design shows, transformation shows, you know, makeover shows, basically, and launched a couple of really big ones almost by accident with really talented people here. And as those grew in popularity, we sort of started to get pegged as the place to bring lifestyle shows. And there was a point where I was like, I can't do this my whole life. Like, I don't care enough about interior design and things to put as much time and energy into that kind of project. So we do less of that, although if there was a creative way into something new that really allowed people to think, I would look at it. But we haven't done any lifestyle shows for quite some time. And when we decided not to pursue lifestyle shows anymore, somebody asked me what we wanted to do, what we might want to do. And I said, move into scripted comedy or drama. And the advice of this guy who I mentioned it to, who was quite well known at the time in Canada, he said, then pick a project that you want to work on for a really long time, because it'll take a long time to get it going, and you it's easy to be sick of it before it ever even you're ever producing it. And that's where Little Mosque on the Prairie came from. Was that we happened upon a really creative woman who was interested in doing something funny about her community, and she was Muslim. And this was just post 9/11. In fact, we started developing it in 2005, and we launched it in 2007. And it just made headlines all over the world when we launched that show, because it was the world's first Muslim comedy. And the interesting thing about it, and the reason that we developed it, and the reason that we fell in love with it, was that we created a situation where a mosque ends up in a church, in a parish hall. And by setting up a situation in a comedy, the situation part of the comedy in sitcom, where two religious communities are rubbing up against each other and have to figure out A, how to make it work, and B, how similar they are to each other. That series, you know, just broke all the records. It was, we've had that series in over 120 countries now, and you know, it's always airing someplace in the world, and that's, we made 91 episodes of it. So it was quite a simple idea, but one that really resonated, not just at the time, but in a lasting way, and one that we were interested in as Baha'is, particularly because we were interested in how communities work together to solve their problems, and also just showing ordinary people living ordinary lives and trying to diminish this idea of othering using narrative comedy. And then we also work in the documentary space as well. And those ones, I would say, are often subject matters that just pop up in our minds, or we know somebody who's doing work in a particular area that intrigues us. And so we did recently a feature-length documentary featuring Paya Makavan, who's quite a rock star human rights lawyer who does a lot of work with The Hague and the International Criminal Court. And so we did a documentary called In Search of a Better World that was exploring, I would say, trying to explore and think about genocides and where they come from and how to kind of frame that in the long lens of the advancement of civilization. In other words, how do we engage with such big ideas and in fact find our way of being able to prevent these things, and very much at the grassroots. So that was interesting. And then we did another one on called 19 that is also a feature-length documentary about a couple who, when their son was 19 years old, was diagnosed with cancer and over the course of 9 months passed away. And I was very intrigued by the way they coped with their son's death. And, you know, Adam, this is Adam and Karen Robarts, who Adam then wrote a book about his son Hayden and his passing and what they learned, kind of spiritual lessons that they learned along the way as their son finally had to accept the fact that he was going to transition to the next world. And yeah, so there are often these things that we end up pursuing are often because there's something that intrigues us about it, or that we think if people in general understood more about X, Y, or Z, perhaps community building processes in the world could just advance a bit faster, that we could see ourselves in each other and care a little more to do a little more. So yeah, those are different genres that we work in though.
Mary, why don't you tell us about the latest project you're working on?
So right now we're working on a feature-length film. The film is loosely based or inspired by a book which was called Utab that circulated, I think, mostly among Persians over the last couple of years. And Utab is an interesting story. The book itself is an interesting story about a girl who is, in the book, she's actually struggling with a terminal disease, and she finds herself in the hospital where she eventually falls in love with her physician. And very much sort of in the internalized journaling and things like that, you see her process come out about what she's dealing with, what she's afraid of, what she feels she needs to face, especially as a young Baha'i woman. So anyway, somebody gave me this book a number of years ago. And you know when a friend gives you a book and you're a filmmaker and you're like, I think this could make a really good movie, and you think, oh, I can't even read it. I don't want to have to say no. I don't want to, maybe if I just don't address it, it'll just go away, that kind of thing.
Right.
So I'm embarrassed to say that that book was presented to me in 2019. And I think I finally read it in 2020. Mm-hmm. And said, oh, there is something really interesting here. And so my husband and I took the book and we began to just break it down and begin to try to mine the story that's really in it. And what we came away with was, very much, I guess, holding the characters that were in the original book, the two main characters, in a very similar place as where they are in the book, except we had to bring all of that stuff that was internal in that character external in order to make a movie. Mm-hmm. And have her not just sit in a hospital bed and write. That'd be a very boring movie. Yeah, so we came up with this film, which we're actually calling Cast Aside the Clouds. And the title Cast Aside the Clouds comes from a poem of Tahereh. And the poem is really about casting aside the clouds of ignorance, of superstition, of prejudice, which is very much what our film is about.
Can you tell us who Tahereh was?
Yeah, so Tahereh is a very early believer, very early member of the Baha'i faith. Actually, she was first a follower of the Bab, and she was the only female early follower of another manifestation of God called the Bab, B-A-B. The Bab actually is a word which means, literally translated, means the gate, I suppose the gate to something new. And Tahereh woke up to these ideas, these new ideas that the Bab brought about overcoming prejudice. But especially the thing that lit her up was the idea that for the first time in religious history, the Bab proclaimed that women and men were actually equal. It's not that they weren't equal before in the earlier, under the teachings of the earlier messengers of God, but that our society perhaps wasn't, they wouldn't have been able to enact the idea of the equality of women and men. And so this idea now being clearly stated by the Bab that women and men are created equal was something that she really woke up to. And so a lot of her, she's a poetess, a poet in Iran. She began in her poetry very much to express this idea.
She
And
was
so this
very, very courageous woman.
a very courageous woman. I mean, against all odds, without going into too much detail, but against all odds, against her family's wishes, you know, she really stood up to this principle to such a degree that it finally, in the end, cost her her life. And I would suggest for any of your listeners, Warren, to just look up the word Tahereh and poetry together, and you'll find the story of her life. And I assure you, somebody else can tell it with more clarity than I can. But what a stunning example of courage and fortitude and bravery in not only what she wrote, but how she lived her life and the way that she interacted with men in a way that just clearly demonstrated that she knew that she was up to the task, that she had this innate equality
Right.
between any man and herself.
So the title of the film is from one of her poems, you said?
One of her poems, it's from a stanza of her poetry. And it really is about that. In the end, I would say if there's underlying anything in the film or things that we would be exploring it through the characters in our film, it's this idea of seeing through your own eyes and not through the eyes of another person, or actually when you hear something, to be thinking with your own mind about what things actually mean, like thinking, being thinking people. And so in our story, it's a young woman who's actually injured when somebody throws a brick through her father's bookstore window and knocking her off the ladder, where she ends up with a concussion. And she goes to the hospital, and she meets this young doctor, and she's under his care for a while. And you can see that there's some sparks there, but there's also a little bit of expectation on her mother's part that there's a nice Baha'i boy who she might marry from the local area, and wouldn't that be great? And there's also some pushback as they're getting to know each other from her love interests, Hassan's side of the family, who are Muslim and don't necessarily accept that he would be exploring a relationship with a Baha'i. And so you sort of go through this wonderful journey with them as, and I don't want to give away too much, but I'll say that it's probably one of the few love stories where our main protagonist is arrested and interrogated. And I won't let you know how it ends. But it's a very exciting project that I leave on Thursday this week to go to Greece for a week to prep it. We're going to shoot it in Greece, in Athens, because it looks a lot, actually, Athens looks quite a lot like Tehran, which is where our film is set. So I'm going off to scout locations and cast some additional cast members and go with our production designer and our director of photography and sort of try to settle down some of those logistical pieces. And then all of September we'll be there prepping, and in October we'll be shooting. So it's a very busy time and a very exciting time. And I think that it's actually the first, it'll be the first film of its kind that actually has a Baha'i protagonist, and especially a Baha'i protagonist who falls in love with a Muslim man in Iran. So it's, you know, set against the backdrop of what's going on in Iran today. It's not set in the future, it's not set in the past, but very much set now. And so our storylines embrace a lot of the different ways people think about the Baha'i faith in Iran and kind of the story of its original origins going on into the present day and some of the persecution and why Baha'is might be persecuted in Iran. So yeah, it's an exciting time. And, you know, anytime that we bring on a new project, I'm also terrified.
I can imagine.
You're not afraid. Then there might be something wrong. And I'm like, oh, I'm really afraid. So things must be going well.
I just want to get your website out there for people to check out your films. I guess it's westwindpicturesalloneword.com.
Yes, and I think, Warren, that's the perfect motivation for us to get it updated because it's horribly out of date right now. I tell you, producers are the worst at keeping websites and stuff up to date. It's like, right, we're so busy making content, but... yeah, we need to go back and get everything updated. And for sure, starting in September, October, you know, also on West Wind's Instagram account, West Wind Picks, I think it is, you'll start seeing some behind the scenes stuff happening and be able to meet some of our cast and actors, which I'm very happy to say we're attracting really great cast.
That's good.
To the project. In fact, our male lead who's playing Sasan is a young Persian man who just won a Best Actors Award at the Toronto International Film Festival in a short that he was in last year. And he's just like an elegant, wonderful gentleman. And our lead female who's playing Utah is also just extraordinary, you know, just like extraordinary in her desire to learn. Neither of them are actually Baha'is. And so they're both very much engaged in learning about, you know, their characters and in relationship to each other, sort of how that works and what the teachings are and things like that. So that, you know, they bring all of that to the front as well.
Well, I have to say, though, your website does include Cast Aside the Clouds.
Well, that's amazing.
And it even has a call for saying it's now casting, and click below to learn more and submit audition materials.
Well, that's exciting.
Yeah. Yes,
that is there. We're almost done casting it right now. So we're just about there. Like I said, I'm going to Greece because we are producing with a company in Greece as well. So we're trying to bring in some Persians from Greece as well. And so we're really getting to know the Iranian expat community there in Athens, which has been really, really wonderful. What a group of talented individuals are there.
Well, Mary, I want to thank you so much for telling your story and sharing your work with us. It sounds wonderful.
What a pleasure. And thank you, Warren, for all you're doing. You're also a very busy producer in your own right.
Well, thank you. I hope you enjoyed that interview with Mary Darling, co-founder of the production company West Wind Pictures. You can find this interview and other interviews on the website abahaiperspective.com and on the YouTube channel, A Baha'i Perspective. You can find the podcast on Spotify and iTunes. For information specifically on the Baha'i faith, you can go to the website baha'i.org or call the number 1-800-22-UNITE. I hope you'll join me next time on A Baha'i Perspective.
When righteousness is weak and faints, and unrighteousness exalts in pride, then my spirit arises on earth. For the salvation of those who are good, for the destruction of evil in men, for the fulfillment of the kingdom of righteousness, I come to this world from age to age.
And the government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name shall be called Wonderful, Counselor, the Mighty God, the everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and peace, there shall be no end, to order it and to establish it with judgment and with justice, from henceforth, even forever.
When 1,200 and some years have passed from the inception of the religion of the Arabian and the overthrow of the kingdom of Iran and the degradation of the followers of my religion, a descendant of the Iranian kings will be raised up as a prophet.
First Buddha who came upon earth, nor shall I be the last. In due time, another Buddha will arise in the world, a holy one, a supremely enlightened one, endowed with wisdom and conduct, auspicious, knowing the universe, an incomparable leader of men, a master of angels and mortals. He will reveal to you the same eternal truths which I have taught you. He will preach his religion, glorious at the goal, in the spirit and in the letter. He will proclaim a religious life, holy, perfect, and pure, such as I now proclaim.
Christ returned in the glory of the Father.
O Prince of Peace, O Comforter, O Redeemer. Glory.
And I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth were passed away, and there was no more sea. And I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down from God out of heaven. And I heard a great voice out of heaven saying,
Glory, the glory of God, glory, the glory of God, glory of glories, glory to God, glory, the glory of God.
O Spirit of truth, O Son of man, come again.
And in the Holy Quran, God says, God is the light of the heavens and the earth. His light is like a niche in which is a lamp, the lamp encased in glass, the glass, as it were, a brilliant star, lit from a blessed tree, an olive, of neither the east nor of the west, whose oil is beginning to burst into light, though no fire has touched it. Light upon light, God guideth whomsoever he willeth to his light, and of all things God is knowing.
Oh, sinner of men, sinner.
this great human garden, even as flowers grow and blend together side by side.
My drink and thy pleasure, my my hope and praise of thee my action, and remembrance of thee my companion, and the power of thy sovereignty my succorer, and thy habitation my home, and my dwelling place, the seed thou hast sanctified from the limitations imposed upon them who are shut out as by a veil from thee, upon them who are shut out as by a
Son of man, for everything there is a sign, the sign of love is fortitude under my decree, and patience under my trials. O Son of Man, the true lover yearneth for tribulation, even as doth the rebel for forgiveness and the sinful for mercy. Son of man, the temple of being is my throne. Cleanse it of all things that there I may be established and there I may abide. O Son of Being, thy heart is my home. Sanctify it for my descent. Thy spirit is my place of revelation. Cleanse it for my manifestation. For my manifestation. For my manifestation.